You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Boom. Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron along with Susan Giddings. Woo, we got a good show for you today. It's not going to be controversial, but we're going to explain. We're going to explain what the statute says and some other things. People are going to be pissed off. Yes. Now, but before we go into that, we want to say to everybody, thank you so much for making 2025 a great year for the podcast. My gosh, we have a lot of listeners and followers and subscribers and people that download the show, of course, after the show and listen to it. I would say about a third of our new client calls will reference, hey, I saw you guys on the podcast. So, gosh, we want to thank, of course, LA Talk Radio and Sam, but thank all of you for tuning in and watching this show. As technical and as technical as it is, but we appreciate that. We're gonna continue to go hard, strong in 2026. We got more topics. We got some guests here, Dr. Jacono is going to be back, you know, hopefully here in a few weeks, talk some more about personalities and stuff like that. So that'll be good. But again, Susan and I did want to thank everybody. Absolutely. for your support. It means a lot. And anything we can do to help clarify this stuff, because, you know, some people just don't like reading a book. Right? Because we had somebody that was read the book. Here's a chapter. So they have to hear it, right? You're more auditory learners. So we're here for that. All right. And happy new year to everybody. I know it's going to be New Year's Day, God willing, here on Wednesday. So thank you, everybody. We hope everybody has a safe and blessed new year. All right.
Thursday, actually. Wednesday's Thursday? New Year's Eve.
New Year's Eve to me in Bruceville, that's New Year. I'm sorry.
That's close enough.
That's the end all of the right. year, man. You're right.
There you go. Bad.
So is it.
No, that's all right.
In my world.
So we had a question come to us from a listener asking about, and they were looking at the issue of commencement of sentence and earning time credits, and they were looking at filing.
2241,
and so we thought we would dig into this. We do dig into this in the book. We go into detail. We are going to be citing some different statutes and some CFR, but this is one how the Bureau interprets it. I will say, and I'm sure, we have a few detractors that I'm sure listen to us for opportunities to shoot arrows. Yes. But my opinion on this subject is the courts who have ruled against the Bureau on this have gotten it wrong, and they don't need to do any further than look at the language of the policy, the language of the law itself, but also within the larger context of the body of statute regarding the governing of the Bureau of Prisons. So we're gonna jump into this pretty deep. And if you're listening, you may want to listen. If you're listening live, you may want to listen again later to digest it. But the issue at hand is deep within 18 USC 3632. And when I say deep within it, I mean way deep. This is subparagraph D4B. So you got to go down a few layers. But it talks about this section is labeled availability. When are time credits? When can the Bureau apply this? And what it says is, and I'm going to read it exactly, we're going to come back and talk about this language. A prisoner may not earn time credits under this paragraph, talking about time credits, for evidence-based recidivism reduction programs that the prisoner successfully completed prior to the date of enactment of this subchapter, so December 21st, 2018, date of enactment, or during official detention prior to the date that the prisoner's sentence commenced under Section 3585A. Now, the controversy happens because some folks are remanded to custody. Now, for those who maybe are listening and don't have a whole lot of experience, when once a person goes to court and is sentenced, one of two things happen. Either they are remanded to custody and the marshals take him into immediate custody, or they are given a voluntary surrender date, the date by which they show up. You know, the judge gives them a month or maybe 6 weeks to get their things in order. Within voluntary surrender, one of two things can happen. Either the individual voluntarily surrenders directly to their institution of designation, or they voluntarily surrender to the U.S. Marshal's office. When we are talking to our clients, we always tell them, if you have the option, you want to voluntarily surrender to the institution directly. You do not want to have to turn yourself into the U.S. Marshals. And we're going to get into that. So the first question that comes up then is, oh gosh, when can I start getting my time credits? Now, there are different decisions out there, and depending on who you follow and who you're listening to, some will only highlight those cases in which the courts ruled against the Bureau. There are plenty in which the courts ruled for the Bureau. For those of you who don't know, our court system are like little mini fiefdoms all over the country. And depending on the position of that district judge, whether they're in Texas, California, New York, Chicago, regardless of where they are, and you can imagine there is a gamut in terms of political persuasion running from left to right. And depending on how they approached it, their approach to how they read statute, they interpret it one of two ways. Either the Bureau is within the decision that they've made, that they're within the context of the law, and we're going to talk about what the Bureau does and why they're doing it this way in a moment, but either they're going to agree with the Bureau or they're going to disagree with the Bureau. And in some cases, in cases where they've disagreed, the Bureau will, to the extent that they can, honor the order of the court. The Bureau does not consider it precedent setting. It is a one-off. It is one case. When I was still working, I really, really wished our different legal offices would fight more on this issue, because I think the statute is really clear on this. I'm not even really sure where the misunderstanding came from, to be honest. But why do we think the statute is clear? Bruce.
All right, here we go. Let me just get this out of my head and then
you
can fix it. Okay, so let's say somebody goes, I'm in Texas, they go to Limestone County Jail, and there's U.S. Marshals beds there under a contract. The person has to go there. Then finally they get designated by Grand Prairie and they go to their designated institution. And only then now this person, because they've arrived at their designated facility, they can now enroll in First Step Act, right? Do their questionnaires and surveys.
Absolutely.
And do that. Now, my question, and I understand that, and people can argue that all day long, but I'm not going to go there. But what about the person that goes to like Philadelphia, Houston, San Diego, Chicago,
some of the Bureau detention facilities,
Miami,
right?
All those are joints. Can a holdover do their surveys at a regular BOP place, or they won't let them? They'll be blocked.
So there's a couple of different things. So in terms of the self-assessment needs surveys, those are what's on the TruLinks email system. An individual can do those in pretrial. They can do those in holdover, and they can do those at their designated facility. Okay. What the system is set up to do is to go, have you done it? Have you done your needs assessment? That's the important question, right? Initially, that was, and by initially, I mean like now 3-4 years ago, that wasn't the case. And we, and in fact, I worked with the programmer and he did the recoding. I did the case management side of it, but we recoded that. And it was, the reason was very simply, the needs assessments are generated via the TrueLinx system, the in-house email, electronic bulletin board survey system that is available, the True system, right?
Yep.
That is all tied to trust fund. The trust fund system is based on an individual's register number. All that system knows is this person with this register number is sitting in a BOP facility. It does not distinguish between pretrial, holdover, and designated. That's not what it does. All it knows is this person with this 8-digit register number is in the system. And why is that? Because that number is tied to their trust fund account. So we have to think of that as like a big, for lack of a better word, kind of a big bank. Right? Is the person in the system and there's money? Someone who's in pretrial can have money put on their account and can shop in commissary. Someone who's in holdover status can have money on their account and can shop in commissary, right?
Okay.
So the TrueLinx system doesn't care about your incarceration status. So in terms of the needs assessment, yes, they will be able to complete them.
Could they start taking, let's say one of the identified needs is any social peers, and could they start taking a class at Philadelphia or whatever?
They shouldn't. And the reason is they are, if they're sitting there in pretrial status, the system won't register. Because remember, it says prior to the commencement of your sentence. So a person who takes a class in pretrial, because maybe they're looking for their time to move along. Maybe they're wanting to look better when they get to the judge. When that happens.
Whoa. No, I didn't mean pretrial. I meant.
You meant holdover.
Post-conviction. Okay. I'm holding over at a MDC. I did my questionnaires. Now can I start a class?
You can start a class. Doesn't mean time credits are going to start. Because just because you chose to take a class.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't mean your needs assessment was completed, because you will do your needs assessment, but no one is looking at it when you're in holdover status. And that's the big question, why. And some of the courts, and I kind of, when I read some of these orders, I get a little irritated with how the courts seem to think that the Bureau isn't doing this because it's inconvenient. So let's take a step back before we dive more into the first step. Let's just take a step back and talk about some things related to the Bureau. So, and I am going to, I looked it up once and I don't have it in front of me, but way back at some point in time, possibly back when the Bureau was actually created, Congress, through their authority, gave the Bureau the authority and responsibility to manage the prison system, right? So the Bureau establishes count times. They establish commissary lists. They establish what education programs they're going to establish, have, how many staff they're going to have, all of those things that go into running a prison. And one of those things that has been in place since the late 70s is the unit management concept, right? That was actually, it's older than me, as old as we are. Unit management has been a functional part of, I take care of that. as old as we are, unit management as a correctional management concept is actually older than that. It dates back to the late 70s, early 80s. As we moved out of the medical model and into, we went through this phase where like people's like nothing works and all these other things. But we came to this system where instead of having this mass institution, right, we would look at these smaller components. And that's where unit managers, the position of a unit manager was created. Case managers existed before that, but case managers were under a case management supervisor, and now they were under the unit manager. And we added that correctional counselor position. And now these kind of unit-based activities were happening. No longer back in the day, back in the 70s, when you wanted a cell change, if you were asking for a cell change, you went to the captain, right? The captain was in charge of everything. The captain, it was his house. I mean, next to the warden. The captain handled all of those kind of things. And they decided that they were going to have this more, these kind of mini units that would handle day-to-day activities and would interact, and it would promote better communication, and you'd have more people putting eyes on individuals on a regular basis. And if there was changes in moods and things like that, you would know about it, right? And you would kind of have your ear a little closer to the pulse of what was going on in the housing unit. So that's how unit management was born. That did not require any kind of statute or regulation, anything in CFR. The Bureau came and said, you know what? We're going to move to this new concept, and it's going to be unit management. And actually, the Department of Corrections in California and the Federal Bureau of Prisons were early adopters of unit management, right? Okay, so now we have unit management. And now they're looking at what we all know to be initial classification and program review, which again has been in place for decades. Okay. This is that everybody comes in, they have that team, they get those, case manager looks at your PSR, you don't have a high school diploma. Okay. You need to go down to education, get your GED. You got a substance abuse history. Okay. You're going to go over to psychology and you're going to get into some drug treatment. The Bureau was doing that going all the way back into the 80s. Not new at all. But one of the things that the Bureau does have to do to a lesser and greater extent was when they, certain items, they have to promulgate rules. The discipline policy. What are a person's rights under the discipline policy, right? What are the time frames? What are the sanctions? What are the offenses? All of those things are spelled out in the CFR, Code of Federal Regulations. So this is something that the Bureau has tied. This is, well, in the case of discipline, it's actually tied to, conditions of your confinement, right? So, and you could lose good conduct time and stay in prison longer, go to special housing, right? So there's certain due process rights afforded, right?
Right.
So you spell out the Code of Federal Regulations. Well, when they adopted this unit management concept and we have this initial classification and program review process, they promulgated rules. Now, just to back up a little bit, the statutory text, the statutory language that gives the Bureau the responsibility and the obligation to manage the federal prison system, gives them the authority to make those decisions, is found in 18 U.S.C. 4042. A1, first sentence, right? The Bureau of Prisons under the Director of the Attorney General shall have charge of the management and regulation of all federal, penal, and correctional institutions, period. The Bureau is in charge of the prisons and all of the operations within the prison. So now the Bureau decides we're going to unit management. We're going to have this initial. Yes.
What was the director's discretion? Which was that? Remember the
director's discretion that fell. That was under VICLA and categorization of offenses. And it came really heavy into place with the RDAP program, because in the RDAP program, there are certain things in the statute of the RDAP. And we can talk about that another day. But there are another certain day. Things that are specifically like you're out of luck. And then there are other things that are director's discretion, because under the statute that allowed for 3621 early release benefit, Congress said it is the director's discretion. Okay. Now, FSA, the language is different. We'll get back to FSA, but good question.
I bring that up for a reason.
Yes.
Is because Congress gives, and the Attorney General, through the Director of the Bureau of Prisons, a lot of leeway to run the prison system the way they want to run it. Now, there's oversight, Congress, you know, but Susan's bringing up a good point, y'all. That's what time it is. They have all the direction and power to run this, for the most part, the way that they see fit. Go ahead. There we go.
100%. Congress gave the Bureau the authority to run the prisons, period.
Period.
Now, certain subsequent statutes have, to a greater or lesser degree, put what I will say guardrails on what the Bureau can do. In some cases, like the 3621E RDAP, early release benefit under RDAP, Bureau got a lot of discretion. A lot. Mm-hmm. FSA, less discretion. SCA, in between, right? So as different laws are passed and Congress kind of weaves that information in, the problem is sometimes Congress doesn't pay attention to what they've written previously. And then you end up with conflicts in the statute. And anyone who's listened to me for any length of time when Bruce and I are talking about this, there are conflicts within FSA. And I'm actually really pleased with some of the recent changes with Director Marshall and Deputy Director Smith. The June 17th memo was a perfect example of when there was a conflict within the statute, and the Bureau, in working with the administration, was able to navigate that and come up with something that had some benefit. Now, there's still some issues, but for many individuals with short sentences who weren't getting that home confinement because of the way historically home confinement had been figured out, it was because of the statutory language. So the Bureau couldn't just wave their magic wand and say, oh, we're going to look at this differently, because they were dealing with statutory language. When it's non-statutory language, when it's under that general umbrella of 4042, managing the prison, Bureau, it's wide open. I once, years ago, had a mom call in. She was very upset. The institution, there had been some issues on the housing unit, and the unit manager took the microwave for the weekend. And she was very upset about this because, you know, the folks are allowed to buy stuff in commissary and it needs to be heated up in the microwave. And if they're going to be allowed to buy commissary, why are you taking the microwave away? And at one point she said, don't they have rules for this? And I was like, well, yes and no. We have a whole list of what can get you in trouble. Those are the incident reports. But it's a 24/7 operation, and you can't possibly address every single thing a person might do. And can the unit manager take a microwave out of the institution? 100%.
One of our compadres, or comadres, you might say, at Carswell, who went on through the case management sphere and became a warden, et cetera, et cetera. So she's now a warden at FCI such and so. I get a phone call from one of my clients' spouses about the microwaves being discontinued. So this particular warden, who I knew for years and years and years and years, almost as long as you, Susan, minus 3 years, I call her and I say, hey, I'm hearing that you took the microwaves. What happened? And she said, oh yeah, gang member such and such is boiling water and scalding people's eyes out with scalding hot water at a camp. So you know what? We're going to chill on that for a minute until we investigate. So, right?
It happened.
Anyway, it happened.
When I had this conversation, I likened it to, I said to this mom, because she obviously was a mom, and I'm a mom as well, and I said, you know how sometimes when our kids are acting up and we take that Game Boy from them or that Nintendo from them and we take it for a week, maybe several days, but we want them to appreciate the fact that they have it. And sometimes they need to be reminded of that. I said, that's what unit managers can do. If they're not going to, now in the case, this case, it wasn't as serious as assaults. But if they're not going to use the equipment as intended, then maybe if they go without for a few days, they'll be reminded about how much they appreciate having one. And the conversation ended on a much more jovial note, because she was literally yelling at me when she called, and I had to kind of talk her down some. But there is a lot of discretion on day-to-day activities. So certain activities, because it ties into either conditions of confinement, sentence length, etc., the Bureau will propagate rules language, right? And the rules language, it's an administrative process in government. The Bureau formulates some rules language. It goes up to DOJ. DOJ takes however long they're going to take to bless it. It then goes out for publishing. Comments get to be made from the general public. And then it comes back in, and maybe they tweak, maybe they modify some stuff, maybe they don't, depends on the comments. And then it becomes rules language. And then the Bureau takes and writes their policies, and the policies will identify rules language versus what we call implementing text. And it used to be back in our day, right? Rules language was bolded. Today, rules language is in blue text in Bureau policy, so anybody can look at a policy. And as you're going through, if you don't see, if it's older, it's bold. If it's newer, it's in blue. But there are policies out there that are strictly implementing text. There's absolutely no rules language associated with them. Other policies are very heavily filled with rules language. So when it comes to initial classification and program review, there are some rules language. And in the case of that, it's 28 CFR 52411. And that rules language spells out for God and everybody how initial classification is going to work. Every individual, upon arrival at their designated institution, will receive an initial classification within 28 days of arrival. Depending on whether they have more than 12 months or less than 12 months, they will receive a subsequent program reviews every 90 or 180 days throughout the remainder of their incarceration. They are also required to provide, the Bureau, is required to generate a program review report, which, and I'm going to read this only because it predates FSA, but it might sound familiar. The report will includes information on an inmate's apparent needs and offers a correctional program designed to meet those needs. The Bureau was assessing needs and making recommendations for programming long before FSA. Okay.
Absolutely.
That's what initial classification and program review is about. And they spelled out in this language, because if you are sitting there in an institution, forget FSA, just in general, if the Bureau says you're getting every individual upon arriving at their designated institution will receive an initial classification within 28 days, what does that mean? They will receive it. Now, there are some very specific reasons to delay that, but that delay has to be documented. So FSA rolls around. And what do we have on FSA? Well, we already talked about what the language said, right? Don't get credit for programs completed prior to the date of enactment or for during an official detention prior to the date the prisoner's sentence commences. It does not say when the person can earn time credits or when the person can start earning time credits. What it says is this is when they can't earn time credits.
I thought they could earn time credits at start when they finish their needs assessment and start. They're in the opt in the inbox
after the commencement of the sentence. The Bureau,
yeah,
as part of their management of the correctional facility and the incorporation of the other requirements under the FSA statute. So what did the FSA statute say that the Bureau had to do, right? Because we're talking about what's in the statutory language. The FSA said the Bureau has to develop a risk and need assessment system and determine the recidivism risk of each prisoner as part of the intake process and classify each prisoner as having minimum, low, medium, or high risk for recidivism. Have to do that. The Bureau had to determine the type and amount of evidence-based recidivism reduction programs that were appropriate for each prisoner and assign each prisoner to such programming based on the prisoner's specific criminogenic needs. So now in and this is for those following along. This is 18 U.S.C. 3632. And we have started, we're at block A. We're at the first subparagraph. And the first subparagraph goes into 8 elements that the Bureau had to do. And to summarize kind of quickly here, the Bureau has to assess a person's risks, assess a person's needs, assign them to programming, and then throughout their incarceration, periodically reassess both their risk and their need. Now, for those of you that are old like me and have been a case manager since dinosaurs roamed the perimeter, that's what initial classification and program review is. Assess for need. Identify program recommendations. At subsequent teams, monitor participation and completion and reassess and reassign as appropriate. That's what team is. So then when it came time to implement the law, so we have a law that says, okay, Bureau, you have to do all of these things. The Bureau says, okay. The law also, in this same section, 3632, but down further, talks about time credits. Okay. A prisoner except for those ineligible, so we're not talking about ineligible folks, who successfully completes evidence-based recidivism reduction programming or productive activities shall earn time credits. Okay, so what is that telling us? The Bureau doesn't have the discretion, if you meet the eligibility criteria under the law and you're doing you're completing evidence-based and recidivism.
Or on the waiting list, right?
You've agreed to participate, right? Mm-hmm. So you're complying with, you have a program of things that have been recommended to you based on your identified needs. And you're like, yep, I'm on board. I'm going to do everything you tell me to do, right? As long as they're doing those things, the Bureau can't decide not to give you credit. Okay? So, going with the statutory language, sometimes there's lots of discretion. Sometimes there's little or no discretion. This would be an example. If you're doing everything you're supposed to do, the Bureau shall award credit. Okay, so how does the Bureau award credit? A prisoner shall earn 10 days of time credits for every 30 days of successful participation in evidence-based recidivism reduction programming and productive activities, and 2, a prisoner determined by the Bureau of Prisons to be at minimum or low risk for recidivating, who over the course of 2 assessments has not increased their recidivism risk, shall earn an additional 5 days for every 30 days of successful programming. What does that tell us? It tells us that time credit, earning of time credits, is tied to program participation and risk assessment. And program participation is tied to needs evaluation. Not just the few self-assessments that you might do at any time, pre-trial holdover, once you get to your designated facility, but all 13 needs assessments. So what we have is A, time credits are tied to specific things. Time credits are not based on getting sentenced. And that's where the problem occurs, is some courts have said, oh, you can earn time credits as soon as you're sentenced. And that's not what the law says. The only thing the law says is you can't earn time credits for things you did before commencement of right. your sentence. And commencement of your sentence is that point when you're in official detention, right? So either you have been sentenced and remanded, right? Now you're in official detention, serving your sentence, your sentence has commenced, or you were given a voluntary surrender date and you get to your, you start serving your sentence. Now, in the case of those who are remanded to martial custody, right?
There's no language that says, and you have completed your assessment.
Well, it's tied in there because it talks about, it is, but it's not that clean and neat, right? That's what the policy says.
Because that is the issue, particularly for the people who their sentence has begun. They're in U.S. Marshals, holdover jails, wherever, with no access to the
There's no access to... There's no access to the needs assessment sitting in martial custody in a jail facility, in a martial jail. There's no access to that. There's no risk assessment being done. You don't even exist in the Bureau at that point in time. Like, literally, yeah.
we you have don't, had families. But you are serving. Families.
Go ahead.
Right. You're but serving you are your serving sentence. Toward. Thank you.
Yes, because your sentence has commenced. Once you move into official detention, be that you're remanded to custody, you voluntarily surrender to the U.S. Marshals, or you voluntarily surrender to the institution. At that point, your sentence has commenced, and any day you serve is served toward your sentence. That's not the issue. The issue is, in order to get time credits, you have to complete the needs assessment, all 13 of them. Not just the ones that you have to do, but the ones that staff do, or the ones that are done in combination. All 13 needs areas need to be assessed. The risk assessment needs to be completed. And you have to be assigned to programming. So your needs assessment is complete. Your risk assessment is being done by your case manager at your initial classification. And the case manager says, okay, looking at what's your needs assessment that have been completed so far, it says you've got some anger issues. So we're recommending participation in anger management. That's the case manager making a recommendation. And you're sitting there and you're like, I ain't got no anger issues. I just am tired of dealing with irritating people. I don't need to be in an anger management class. At which the case manager, if they were trained by me, should be saying, okay, you understand by declining to participate in anger management when you have a identified need in anger and hostility, you are opting out of programming and therefore you're not able to earn time credits. And the person says, I don't care about that. I'm not doing that class. Okay. Therefore, you're not placed on a waiting list. Right? That's the assignment. So there has to be an affirmative process. It's not like good conduct time where it is a function of your sentence.
Right. Right.
Federal time credits are a function of several things: a risk assessment, a needs assessment, an assignment of to programming. And by assigning to programming, we mean you, the individual sitting in prison, is agreeing to participate in those programs. None of that happens when you're in holdover status. In fact, if you look at the policy on initial classification and program review, it specifically says individuals in holdover status aren't teamed. They just aren't teamed.
Oh, man.
Because they're not at their designated, they're literally in holdover. It is a temporary situation. Now, how long are they in that situation? In most cases, they're moving within a few weeks. If you're out at Hawaii, where the marshals don't do frequent movements, you're in a rough situation.
You could be at Pahrump. You could be
if
at Pahrump.
If you go in, if you voluntarily surrender
in Nevada,
US, and be, oh God, yeah. If you voluntarily surrender to the U.S. Marshals, you could be in Marshals custody for months before you make it to a Bureau facility. That's why always, 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 if you're voluntarily surrendering, you voluntarily surrender to the institution.
If at all possible. My heart goes out. Yeah, and my heart goes out to that individual or individuals with a 2-year sentence that got somehow racked up in transit to they're serving their sentence, but they're in a non-blessed and ordained institution. And now all of a sudden, man, if I had taken my surveys, oh, ouch. But anyway, hopefully that's an exception rather than a rule, Susan. So
And it is for the most part. I get frustrated when I would be responding. In fact, I wrote a declaration for an individual that was in Hawaii, and I said, you know, it would be more effective for the court to order the U.S. Marshals to effectuate the transfer of the person. When a person is in holdover status, they are not a Bureau inmate.
And right, they're a Marshals
prisoner. Even if they're a Marshals inmate, and even if they're sitting in a detention center, they are not doing the same kind of thing.
BOP custody, technically.
They're not BOP custody. Yeah. You know, there's actually a memorandum between the U.S. Marshals and the Federal Bureau of Prisons to make available those detention beds for them. But the thing where it really gets people confused, and we've seen it happen, is they're sitting in a federal detention center, and maybe they've taken programs. The thing is, they haven't had a team meeting, which has reviewed their needs, assessed their risks, and made a recommendation. And those are things that are part of the
to
law.
Consummate the deal, yeah.
Right, right. And we have some courts, and I won't name names because a few of them irritate me. We had a court who required the Bureau, ordered the Bureau to give credit to someone who was sitting in a county jail. How that even remotely complies with the law.
Right.
No risk assessment, no need assessment. They weren't even taking programs, or if they were, we didn't know what they were in the Bureau because they weren't programs that were identified as evidence-based recidivism reduction programs or productive activity. Every single program that is in the program guide that's located on the BOP website as an EBBR or PA has gone through some level of review. If it's a productive activity, there's an internal review that connects that program to criminogenic needs and recidivism-related issues, even if it's not all the way to evidence-based programming, or they've gone through a level of research has been done to support this being relevant to reducing recidivism.
Right.
That doesn't happen when you're sitting in a county jail. And that judge did that was wrong.
Was it a magistrate? Was it like a for real?
It was a magistrate judge up in, leave it at the Northeast.
But you know, and I'll take this one step further for our big 2241 fans. And I've seen this happen back in CARES Act, which was the precursor when we had COVID. Remember all that, y'all? And First Step was alive. But yet, anyway. I say, you know what? The judge can re-sentence the person. The judge can modify their sentence if they feel like they. But it's harder to tell the BOP what to do. BOP, I want you to do this. Well, can you really tell me what to do? But the judge can modify their own sentence. So if the judge feels like I just take off 36 months, take off 18 months. The judge can do that, and you know what? We will comply. We won't say nothing.
Absolutely. Right. And again, I wish on some of, and of course I'm not in the legal sphere, so I got to weigh in and I was ignored. In some cases, is why aren't we arguing? That was my question. I used to ask the lawyers, why aren't we fighting this? Why are we just letting this go? Well, it's just one. Maybe it's in a district or in a circuit that is less friendly to the Bureau and they're not willing to listen to the Bureau. That happens. The lawyers make decisions about what cases they're going to try to challenge. But even with a challenge, they still have to abide by the order. And in a lot of cases, the amount of credit that's actually being given is days. I mean, when you consider 30 days is only gets you 10 days of credit. So, you know, the person that goes and maybe they were sitting in Marshall custody while they were in transit, maybe they were there for 2.5 months. Okay. That's still 20 days. And from the Bureau, the legal folks, you know, and the solicitor, because the Bureau also doesn't make a decision. They don't have the final decision of when they're going to appeal. When they're going to appeal. It goes to the Solicitor General and Maine Justice. And from Maine Justices, at least in the previous administration, they were like, 20 days, it doesn't matter, just give it to them. It's a one-off, we're not worried about it. But that then sets this case here and this case here. And then you end up with a body of cases that are one-offs, but we've got this court over here agreeing with the Bureau and this court over here disagreeing with the Bureau. None of these cases have elevated to the circuit level. I have often said I really wish Congress would rewrite this language to be more specific and fix it. But until it either they fix it or it works its way to the Supreme Court where we have because we do have multiple districts saying different things, there really isn't an answer. But from the Bureau's perspective, the law is silent when it comes. It only says this is when you cannot earn time credits. The other part, it doesn't say anything about it starting with commencement of sentence. It just says it can't prior to commencement. So then the Bureau took that information coupled with all of the things that they have to do, risk, need, assigning of programs, and said, you know what? This fits with initial classification and program review. And FSA is really just another program. RDAP, SCA, anything else, it's just another program. The stakes are higher with time credits, but it's just another program. We do go into all of this in detail in our book, Unlocking Federal Time Credits, second edition. And we have all the citations there if you didn't get that. So, but we are deep in the weeds. This is one of those things. And, but it's an important topic. And,
charged up.
Yeah, it's an important topic. And it was a good question. We thank our listener that sent the question.
Oh, boy. They sent a spreadsheet, a bunch of stuff. Boy, they had everything. Just lined out, you know what I mean, and bless their heart. So it's just it is what it is. But all righty then. Well, we got final comment from you, Susan.
A
little bit of time.
Yeah. So you know, I know some people might be sitting there and going, "Well, if I file a 2241, you know, maybe the judge rules in my favor." And my answer is, yeah, maybe they will. I wrote a whole lot of declarations when I was still employed arguing against it, and I won some and I lost some. And it's because of the makeup of our judicial system. And so it doesn't cost anything to file a 2241. Bruce and I do not do that. That's a legal process. We're not lawyers, but you can download, your family can download that fill in the blank form off the U.S. court website system, and you can fill it out and you can give it a try.
Yeah. But don't abuse it. You know what I mean? You, if you're going to do it, make sure you're doing it. Don't do anything frivolous or don't abuse it.
Right. I mean, you can still, but it's going to come down to that opinion of that magistrate. Right. Is that a magistrate is your institution in an area that the magistrate is like, I don't care, I'm going to do what I want. I jokingly say the only difference between God and a federal judge is God doesn't think he's a federal judge. So it's going to come down to, are you located in a prison where the judge thinks they're God, or where the judge is following the law?
And that's a wrap, folks. Thanks for that's coming a wrap. And listening to our show today. As you can tell, we just barely opened the can, but we'll get back in the can next week if we need to. Of course we will. And come to Amazon Audible to see this, and listen to us. Come to Apple Podcast. Of course, all our shows are on the LA Talk Radio website, the videos, the sound files, all that's there too. So, and we have a YouTube channel, and of course our Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison, First Step Act, our ever so steady Facebook group. So lots of points of contact. Thanks for listening today, and we'll see everybody here next time on Around the Block.
Thanks. Send your questions. Bye-bye. Yeah.
Bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.